Welcome. I will go around and say hello to everyone, starting with Mark and Linda B and her cutie pie, Jim, Bob K, Susan, Tyler, Paulette, Marv, Karen, Gaffel, Jinryu, Pat, John, Aaron, Alice, Joan, Peter, Linda R, and her cutie pie. Oh my God, Katie. Franklin, Sabrina, Drew, and Ruth Ann. Oh, all right. Let's see. I guess announcements. Our Jukai ceremony will be June 27th. And we've got to make some plans. We'll have all six people who are receiving the precepts this year are not local, are not from Oregon, interestingly. And two of them are flying to town to do the ceremony in person. So I figure we have to have a hybrid ceremony, right? We have to like have those two people in person, probably at our Zendo, and not very many other people there, but then also hook it up for everybody else to participate at the same time. So we got some planning to do, but it should be cool. And then because it will be online, then everybody should be able to witness. So please save that date. It will the Jukai ceremony will essentially, it'll happen essentially the same time that the Dharma talk would usually take place on a Sunday. And also the August retreat. So I've already mentioned this on Sunday. I haven't changed the details on the website yet, but we will be doing a retreat during that time. And if we have things all set up at the Zendo, it might be a hybrid thing where we have some, only those who are registered and vaccinated in person, but also, you know, the online participation option. So I really encourage you to set aside those dates for some kind of participation anyway. It's an incredible balm to just put everything down to whatever extent your life allows you to do periodically. So I think that's it. Any questions or other things that I should announce? Okay. All right. Tonight we have the precept, do not become intoxicated. And Pat is leading our class. So take it away, Pat. And let me know if you need any tech support, Pat, at any point. You're still muted.
It took immense courage for me to do this. So, but I have put my resources on, and interestingly enough, the topic, I think, is one I really was afraid of. And so I've looked at it. I'm relying mostly on Waking Up to What You Do. That was the book that we used the year that I took Jukai by Diane Eschen Rizzetto, but and I put the resources that I used. They're not proper bibliography, but you could find them, I think. These days, you don't need that, but Google. So I'm going to start with some overview of this topic, because it seems like it reminds me the topic itself of do not become intoxicated reminds me of the commandments or the or AA or something, and I think maybe that is part of what I was struggling with. So the first kind of overview, and I'm going to be doing some reading. This is still not an area. The whole thing is coming on me slowly, so I don't feel like I can talk without support. But I've got a book called Precept Study Guide that was developed by the Dharma Rain Zen Center. And it's basically recordings and then transcription and then editing, I think. But the initial overview says, do not become intoxicated. Polish clarity, dispel delusion. In the realm of the intrinsically pure Dharma, not harboring delusions is the precept of not becoming intoxicated. We are naturally pure. There is nothing to be deluded about. This is enlightenment itself. Understand this truly, and no intoxicants can be taken. It is wonderful how this precept connects intoxication with delusion, because both involve clouding over the naturally clear mind. Buddhist texts sometimes refer to the wine of delusion because we become intoxicated with our own opinions. There's nothing to be deluded about. Point a spacious mind where not one thing arises. How can there be delusion about that? Dropping all opinions, we can see it clearly. Intoxication with wine is really no different. It is choosing confusion over clarification. And I thought that was really helpful. The pamphlet itself then follows with participants' questions and comments and the teacher's responses. But I'm hoping that we have our own questions. I'm going to spend most of the time on waking up to what you do, because I think that Diane has some really helpful analogies and recommendations. It has more to do with 12 steps than it does with unclouding your mind. And I was kind of glad about that. So her title to the chapter is, I Take Up the Way of Cultivating a Clear Mind. And I think her point of view is really helpful. I've heard it said that 90% of getting along well in life is in showing up for it. I'd add to that showing up fully in each moment. Being present is not just being present in body alone, but in my body and clear mind. This precept, sometimes worded as not giving or taking drugs, not indulging in intoxicants, or not clouding the truth, encourages us to take an honest look at the ways we don't show up by clouding our experience through the use of intoxicating substances and addictive behaviors. We may acknowledge at some level that all the moments of our lives are teachers, but we don't always want to meet the teacher, and sometimes we seek to control or regulate our experience in a variety of ways. This is a form of escape that not only can lead us into further ignorance, but also can lead us to taking actions out of greed and anger. If we have any hope of being free from the habitual swings of our reactions if we have any wish to live more openly and freely, if we seek to, as writer Barbara Kingsolver says, look life in the eye and love it back, then we need to take a look at what's clouding our view. This is what any teacher offers us, a clear view of our clouding. But in order to even recognize the teacher, we need to be awake. This is, first of all, what this precept is about, being awake and present for our teachers. It points to the ways in which we play hooky or daydream in the back of the class of everyday teachings that present themselves to us as we go through our ordinary activities. Secondly, it directs us toward cultivating the potential clarity we all possess by shining a beacon on the ways we pollute that clarity by use of the substances and other behaviors. One way to think about the mind's innate clarity is by comparing it to, I really like this perspective, is by comparing it to rich, unworked soil, full of possibilities and nutrients, teeming with millions of insects and microorganisms and bacteria and enzymes, standing ready in full potential to interact and bring forth whatever seeds are planted there, much like a gardener carefully cares for the soil by not adding pollutants and toxic substances. So that it's full of potential, can nurture and grow seeds planted. We can cultivate a mind that is rich, open, ready to cultivate the seeds planted by life's events, our teachers. This precept is not about changing our mind, but rather it's about inquiring into the ways we get lost in obscuring or clouding it. It's about making use of the clarity that is already ours for the taking, the clarity that allows us to cultivate whatever seeds life brings to us. So this already enlivened me with the idea that it was about mind. It wasn't about absence. And I think she says, she points out, originally the precept focused on the use of alcohol, but later it was expanded to include the use of other substances like marijuana, tranquilizers, hallucinogens, and so forth. Today, we can think of more subtle ways we turn from being present by using and abusing not only mind-altering drugs, but also caffeine, cigarettes, food, and activities like exercise, TV watching, internet surfing, working sensory highs, or anything that can turn us from the immediate experience of our minds and bodies. So in exploring this precept, we focus not so much on what particular drugs or activities are acceptable to use, but rather what our intention is and how we can use any substance to engage in any activity that drives us further into our habitual ways of meeting the events and circumstances of everyday life. My point is that alcohol, drugs, TV, whatever, are not escapes in and of themselves. What makes them escapes is how to use them. So she has, that's her main introduction. And I thought it might be useful just to open it up for some discussion if people have a point of view. I know that the people that that were in the class the year that I did the Jukai probably already have this book, and some of you may too. But you may have a different perception of what she's saying here. So I would welcome any comments. Or not.
Give people a moment. Go ahead and just unmute yourself or raise your hand electronically. And I'll let you call on people, Pat, but if you don't see somebody, I'll do it. Ruth Ann?
Oh, hi. Thanks for the introduction, Pat. You know, of course, we know drugs can be an addiction, but you know, we live in a culture where shopping is a religion. And I mean, of course, we all need to buy food and necessities, but any accountant will tell you people who can't manage their own accounts, shopping is an addiction for some people, where they can't, they get so in debt, they feel they're drowning. Just wanted to put that out there. Thanks.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Peter?
A few days ago, I received a catalog from Crutchfield, the audio company that just has many different stereos and headphones and things. And I was thinking about my car, and I went into my car, which is 3 years old. It's a Camry hybrid. And I was wondering, is there an upgrade I can do or should do? And to cut to the chase, I realized that probably much more important than, can I increase the fidelity? Can I get into a fun conversation about buying something to enhance my life? I thought, no, I think it's far more important which stations I choose to use on my radio or stream from my phone. Am I just listening to entertainment, or am I using this sound system to look carefully? And so, you know, I'm hoping that it's relevant that, you know, we don't have to necessarily use substances as much as we also just need to stop listening to our own entertaining thoughts. And really, I like the term polished clarity, really make sure we're listening to the right conversation. Because even if I get the best stereo and I listen in marvelous sound, if I'm on the wrong channel, it's just as harmful.
Anyone else? Yeah, Tyler.
Yeah, I was just thinking about, I think over the last year, when we've all been facing more stressful situations, being in lockdown or in our homes, there was just a huge influx of purchases through like Amazon and through, you know, and just people were dealing with this sort of stress and sadness with this sort of really increased purchasing. And like, you know, we saw it happening in our household too, where all of a sudden, you know, all of a sudden the Amazon packages were showing up at our house and at a much higher frequency than normal. And some of it was necessary, but some of it was certainly, you know, not. It was just sort of this, I think it was just sort of a way that, one way that people were dealing with a stressful situation was this, instead of sitting down and feeling it or allowing these feelings to happen, we were clicking and just like getting that sort of high of, okay, something's coming, like this will be good, right? Like something new is coming. I got my little tracking number. Okay. Like something's coming, you know? And it was just sort of, yeah, kind of an ongoing, and it just, I mean, you see the trucks going up and down the streets everywhere. It's just, it's really, it was quite impressive, or not impressive, kind of sad, but you know, incredible to see how quickly that happened. It seemed to go around.
I don't think your place was the only place. Franklin.
Yeah. Hi. So on this one is interesting to me because I think, you know, at the surface level, we're talking about substances, whether they be behavioral escapes or, you know, drugs or whatever. And so I think, you know, I kind of think of this in two ways. One is like escapism, right? Like the fact that we often are running away from all kinds of things. But then on the other side of this thing, it talks about dispelling delusion. And to me, that's almost a bigger fish to fry in the sense of, you know, obviously in chasing intoxicants or escaping from whatever you're trying to escape from is a delusion, but delusions seem like a greater set of possible activities to me, you know, and I often wonder, like, with delusions, you know, it's what you don't know about yourself that scares me the most sometimes. Like, okay, well, where are my delusions hiding, you know? So anyway, I'm kind of rambling a little bit, but I find this whole idea really interesting of dispelling delusion. And what does that really mean, you know? So hopefully we'll get into that a little more.
Yeah. There is a her next section, I think I'll go ahead. I'm excited to share this because I'm excited to delve into it more. It's really helpful to have a group to do that with. Her next section is the practice. It's the same chapter. She says, we begin our work by inquiring into the ways in which we may try to control or regulate our thoughts, feelings, and body experiences. By tuning out, tuning up, and turning on. I have found the range of experiences of people working with this precept is very wide. Some people never drink or use drugs at all, so are convinced at the beginning that they could probably just skip this precept. Others have a history of substance abuse and are scared to death of it. Some have found by first exploring this precept a bit that they are dealing with a much deeper physical addiction than they had realized. And the enter here sign above the door directs their way into treatment and recovery. Others come to it after years of recovery and want to explore the deeper patterns of their addictive behavior. Well, she has a suggestion. A good way to begin exploring this precept is to pick a substance or activity that you regularly engage in with some attachment. In other words, you'd have some reaction if you couldn't do it, and begin observing yourself internally while using or engaging in that activity. And so she has this example, and I think I'll just go ahead with the example because I think it's kind of easy to relate to, but this topic is deepening the inquiry. How many ways can one drink a glass of wine? One person I know is a wine connoisseur. In fact, he hesitated to begin precept work for quite a long time because he thought he would have to give up his hobby of wine collecting, including daydreaming and meditation by mentally rearranging his wine cellar. To begin his practice, he decided to take at least 5 minutes to sit in silence, observing his mind and body state, agitated, calm, tense, relaxed, before he poured a glass of wine. 5 minutes may not seem very long, but when you are keeping yourself from engaging in a habitual form of avoidance, it can seem like an eternity. What he came up with at the end of 2 weeks was that he could drink a glass of wine in many different ways, depending on what was going on in his thinking as he reached for the glass. Sometimes he was fully present as he smelled the fullness of the aroma and tasted the layers of flavor passing across his tongue. He said that in those times, he had no thought of taking the next sip and how full his glass was or how much was left in the bottle. His mind and body were pretty level before he began. Other times he had the opposite experience. He experienced tenseness and agitation and could hardly wait to gulp down the first glass. And I really appreciated a description of observing yourself and what you do and how you feel about it. And so I thought that was something I'd like to hear from other people is how they, because I think it takes some courage to find that you have are using something to cloud and then to try and explore it further. Now, I would love to hear what someone else has to say about that. It's kind of scary. Alice.
So I have an addiction to coffee. And it sounds like benign, but I was reading Rosetto as well, and the jitters I get before I even think of making a cup of coffee, I think to myself, oh, okay, now I can turn on now, you know, which I mean, like, you can like extrapolate to multiple jokes, you know, there are sweaters with slogans on there and stuff, but then like, in looking, I think she like later talks in her book about like, you have to really examine the requirements for things, right? Like, what is it that you're turning away from or turning towards while you are partaking in this substance, be it TV or heroin or coffee? And I think it's like kind of this requirement for me to be always engaged and always on and always alert. And like, it's almost like societal push towards that kind of a mother or that kind of a female figure, and not someone who just is tired and like, you know. So yeah, I think examining one's requirements is like clutch to figuring out what exactly are you turning away or turning towards.
Aaron? Thanks, Alice.
Thanks, Pat. You know, just so I don't know that this is 100% on point for this, although it's just, it triggered something in me in terms of, you know, using the substance or using whatever to sort of investigate behaviors behind it. One of the up and coming things, certainly, and I think we're going to see more and more of it coming into certainly therapeutic use, is different psychedelics in terms of how those can be used to look at underlying behaviors that, you know, that, or, you know, underlying conditions such as addiction, right? So, I mean, I have an experience. I went to Peru a few years back, and I did. I went to an ayahuasca retreat center when I was in Peru, and I participated in a couple of ceremonies because I'd long heard, you know, there's academic literature out this, but a lot of the, you know, a lot of the pieces that different people bring in, especially dealing with alcohol and heroin addiction, and how, you know, using ayahuasca in conjunction with therapy and in conjunction with, you know, traditional healing methods have between a 60 and 90% success rate of helping people with heroin and alcohol addiction. And I don't have an alcohol addiction, and I don't have a heroin addiction, but it's also, you know, used potentially to look at underlying behaviors, you know, how you are towards other people, you know, how you behave with other people. And so I am curious, and I don't know if anybody has any thoughts on this, but what you were saying, Pat, what, you know, sort of what Alice was saying too, was, is there a sense in which, you know, those types of, you could call them an intoxicating substance, because, you know, there are hallucinations associated with it, right?
Right.
Can somehow actually trigger that deep, not just surface level, but a deep level reflection, you know, when used as a healing substance, right? I'm not talking about using this recreationally or using any similar substances recreationally, but in a therapeutic sense. So I don't know if that has anything to do with what you're saying, but that's sort of what came up for me. Thanks, everybody.
I have read about those studies as well, and have heard about some success rates. And it And I think in our society overall, it's not real easy to think about, because it sounds wrong. We've been staying away from drugs so long, and then it just doesn't sound like they're going to be the healing thing. Anyone else? Yeah, Paulette.
So I feel like, what I want to say here. Turning towards or turning away from something. I mean, whether it's alcohol or drugs or my cell phone or, food. I think this could apply to anything, because I mean, anything can be used as a means of avoidance or as a means of delusion. So maybe it's not so much about the substance, and it's more just about the what's going on around that. Because I know, I feel like I have a little bit of a internet addiction. And certainly a green tea latte addiction. And, so I don't remember who was talking about this, but who was it? About the investigating, I think it was Franklin, investigating your feelings before you engage in it. I think that's crucial, because it doesn't matter what the substance is. It's just the way you're using it. And why are you using it that way?
This is so much richer. Yes. Karen.
Hi. So I have an adult son that does have a substance abuse disorder. He's addicted to several different drugs. So occasionally, a couple times a year, I just decide to try to give up something that would be super hard for me to give up, which is completely different than his addiction, but it's just kind of this exercise I go through. And it's always sweets, anything just specifically chocolate. And it is super hard. I mean, I just start getting obsessed about, it makes me think about it even more than I, had before, when I know I can't have it. And of course, I know I only did it for a month. So it's like 30 days, and then I know I can have it again. So it's very different than what people with a genuine addiction has. But you're talking about escapism, or how we deal with these things that might be delusions. When I come home, it seems to be stress related. When I come home from work, I just want that chocolate. So when I'm going through this exercise, a month at a time of depriving myself of it, I don't sit and think about what's happening through my body or what's happening in my mind. I just divert myself to other activities so I don't have to think about it. So it sort of doesn't work at all for me, but it always is interesting, and it's just really, really difficult to do. And socially, it's really difficult too. Before COVID, I was in several groups that gather together, and there's always dessert. And to have to say no to somebody who's, really proud and excited to share the dessert with people who are coming to their home, that's been interesting too. And that gives me more of a true sense of what my son goes through. And, because alcohol is the big thing that's shared with everybody. Anyway, maybe if I do this again, or not if, but when I do it again, I'll try to focus more on what's actually going on in my mind and body, and try to experience some, clarity with it. So I thank you, Pat. That's a kind of a good direction to go in.
Yeah, I'm I'm especially enjoying it because I'm in digging deeper into it with you guys. It's really fabulous. Diane's next section is engage the observer. I think she has some really good recommendations here, but try it yourself with your own substance or activity, whatever it may be. Remember, the idea here isn't necessarily abstinence, it's exploration. Be open to whatever you experience. Allow it. Say hello. Watch it. Observe it. Get to know it intimately. What does your body really feel like when it has a craving? Feel the physical drive behind switching the channels or surfing the net. Notice that you're thinking or avoiding thinking about. Notice what you're thinking or avoiding thinking about. Get to know your escape. After you've practiced this way for a while and have a sense of what it feels like before, during, and after you have engaged in your preferred method of clouding, you can begin to inquire a little deeper by experimenting with extending your awareness. This is an extension of the practice of sitting for 5 minutes before engaging in activity. Now sit for at least 5 minutes afterward, no matter what your state. This is a lot easier said than done, but it is possible. Another person working with this precept managed to sit for a few minutes, even when he came home late one night after partying and was quite drunk. All he remembered the next day was trying not to fall over, but he learned something. Even if just how to sit in a meditation position while drunk. It's not so simple and takes every ounce of awareness you can muster up, whether it's food, alcohol, exercise, or whatever route of exit you take. You can find your way back by turning toward your body awareness. What is the sensation as you pause 5 minutes before opening the refrigerator door? What are the thoughts and feelings after you shut it? What about when you place the used dishes in the sink after you finished eating or drinking? I don't think I had really thought about this before. I did read the chapter before, but it somehow is hitting me differently this time. Has anybody tried anything like this, like paying attention that much?
It looks like Aaron.
Thank you.
I can just say in a previous life, when I was much more of a what you could call a hardcore prayer, I found it was weird when I was slightly intoxicated, my prayer life would increase, and it would flow easier. Don't ask me how, don't ask me why, but you know, so when you're talking about sitting and how difficult it actually can be in Zazen, that was one of the first things that came to mind, is that I don't know if it's the inhibition went away, but I could definitely see how if you're focused in being in the moment and the reality, how that would be more difficult. So yeah.
I find this discussion, it's hitting me particularly hard this evening, because I've heard this precept presented ever since I've been at Right Way once a year. Those of you who heard my way seeking mind talk back in November know that I have history here. And I can relate this precept to maybe shopping too much, or a coffee addiction, a sugar addiction. But based on my past experiences, if at the same time I had a coffee addiction, I can put down my third cup of coffee and I can still drive a car. I can put down my 10th cup of coffee and I can still drive a car, and there's a darn good chance I will not hurt myself or anybody else. And so when it is something that is not life-threatening, I guess that's the only way I can put it, I can apply this precept in the way that we're talking about here tonight. But had this precept been presented to me as something helpful 43 years ago, I would have been dead before I even understood it. So it depends on the substance we're talking about. There's addiction to heroin, there's addiction to alcohol, there's addiction to chocolate chip ice cream, and there's addiction to caffeine, and there's addiction to gambling. And some of them will break up your family and kill you or somebody else, and some of them will not. So I struggle. I can really glom onto intoxication because I get that. But I struggle with, if it's not intoxication, I mean, I don't even understand what you're talking about. So there are those of us out there and in our rooms here too. That's all.
I don't know if I can find this spot, but there is a, in the reading I did for this, one of the distinctions that was being made was about the, and I think definitely Diane does this, about clouding the mind and clearing the mind. And so I think there is a message in there, and I think it can get lost. And I appreciate your comments, Jenya, because I know those were hard-earned lessons.
I think it's a great example too of how these precepts especially the first five, they occur, they happen at different levels, and it's important. A lot of times when we get together as a Sangha, we talk about, you know, we leap right to like, do not kill, as in do not judge a thought too harshly, and do not kill somebody's enthusiasm, and do not steal means don't cheat yourself out of your own time, and do not misuse sexuality. I don't, you know, like we go right to the subtle, kind of assuming that people don't struggle with the real gritty physical aspect, which is something that they're unlikely to bring up. I mean, you never know. You know, there's people who've served jail time who come to sanghas. They might have actually stolen. They might have been still struggling with this. They might have killed somebody. You don't know. So it's to keep in mind that there are people who are, yeah, and I can imagine that being a little discouraging if you are really struggling with the core physical aspect of the precept. Talk to a bunch of people who are talking about it in a much more subtle way, but the subtle ways, you know, are true, and that's where, for most of us, that's where we spend a lot of time with the precepts. Looks like Franklin is next.
Yes, I appreciate your point, Jinru. I too at certain times have held a bazooka to my head as opposed to death by a thousand cuts. But I think the thing that's in common is that, you know, I guess with things like alcohol or drugs, that they're, it's obvious the harm that's happening, even to yourself at times, sometimes not. But certainly other people notice that. And I think the thinking in some ways can still be the same. So for you, use the example of addiction to ice cream. People have died from eating too much ice cream. And I don't mean to make light of it, but it is a thing. It's when I say, you know, you can hold a bazooka to your head and pull the trigger, or you can, you know, cut yourself with paper a million times. And at the end of the day, they're both kind of doing the same thing. And so, you know, having had my own experience with difficulties, you know, and in recovery, I see that there's still that thinking, and that thinking still shows up. Fortunately for me, in less harmful ways, but I have not made what I would call a major, well, I guess it's hard to say. I was going to say I haven't made a major transformation in my mind yet, but I think maybe I have. So I'll just put that aside. But anyway, I'm not sure what point I'm really trying to make, other than I think it's a continuum. At least for me, it is. And the other point I wanted to make is about, you know, I think at some level, we talk about this at a kind of high sort of psychological way, but I also think there's this fundamental neurochemical thing that we're chasing. I think it was Karen was talking about stress. Well, you know, there's a neurochemical, there's, you know, issues around serotonin and all this kind of at a very basic physical level that you're responding to. And I think in many ways, and this is one of the problems with addictions of all types, is that we change our, we become adapted to higher levels of dopamine, and then we have to meet those things or that level of dopamine. And so, and I think that's why, you know, like people that have dealt with alcohol problems often deal with nicotine problems and sugar problems and all that stuff. I think it's all related. So I guess that's all I have to say right now. Thanks.
Yeah, I think I do struggle with the term intoxication in this precept. And so I'd love to hear more people talk about that. But I do think that the common thread that's running through all of this in this particular precept is polishing clarity. And that is what it says, isn't it? Polish clarity, do not, whatever. And polishing clarity is not something that happens, at least in my experience, in an evening or in a 16-week precept study, or in a couple years worth of practicing Zen, maybe. But it's a lifetime's worth of work. That's all I
I do agree there's coarse levels of addiction and there's more subtle levels of addiction. And there's some that are very, detrimental. Like I see it all the time. People are addicted to their ego and addicted to proving something, you know, and that can be actually very harmful as well. And it's just, you know, I have a history of addiction in my family and I've struggled with it myself. So I'm not trying to make light of it, but I do think that there is a common thread, right? And sometimes you go from something that's very like a coarse addiction to something that's very subtle, but there's like the same kind of flavor runs through all of them.
One of the thoughts that has come to me in doing this investigation is that this idea of being present and of polishing clarity is, when I focus on that, it seems to me that the idea of intoxication and addiction and the precept itself leaves us all having to make some decision at some point. And I wanted a different, bigger picture. As I mentioned, the Dharma Rain Zen Center pamphlet has some discussions of people about it. And so does Diane's book in this chapter. There is some dialogue that goes on. But the third place that I looked for information was Tricycle has an article that's called The Fifth Precept. And it's not really long, so I think I'm going to go ahead and read it because the people who are interviewed here take different perspectives and made me realize that just because I had gotten this far in the chapter and this far in the topic, I had not necessarily established my own perspective. So that it starts out in the 70s, when we wandered up the hill of Kopan Monastery in Nepal, in various states of drug and alcohol-induced intoxication, we would ask Lama Yeshe, what do you think about drugs, alcohol, and meditation? They make us more relaxed, so it's easier to watch our breath, and our visualizations are so much more vivid when we're stoned. Lama looking at us with an expression that was quizzically serious, would say, "You don't need drugs, dear. You're already hallucinating." Then when we stopped laughing, he explained that intoxicants and meditation don't go together. Intoxicants take you away from reality. Meditation takes you toward reality. Which do you want? You are already intoxicated by ignorance and anger and attachment and suffer as a result. Why do you want to take more intoxicants? And that was, I don't know if I can say his name, Bhikshuni Thubten, I can't say it, but the Tibetan Buddhist nun, who was the founder of Sravasti Abbey. So then there's another individual who's giving another opinion. To refrain from taking intoxicants is one of the primary vows that lay people may take and that monastics have to uphold. One of the main reasons for not becoming intoxicated, is obscured when it makes no difference whether one takes in substances or not. From the point of view of the Dharma training I was given, it is permissible, even having taken this vow, as a layperson, to enjoy a glass of wine occasionally. A distinction is made between intoxication, where one's clarity is compromised, and simply enjoying partaking of a substance. I also do not feel that occasionally utilizing a substance for transformational work is an obstacle to awakening. It may be helpful, but honest discernment and consultation is needed if one engages in this way so that one does not fool oneself and go astray. And that was Lama Paldin, a Western female Lama in Tibetan tradition. The purpose of the fifth precept is to help you observe the other four. It, like others, is not a commandment or a rule, but rather a 2,500-year-old suggestion. The issue is heedlessness, not whether the precept applies to that one glass of wine at dinner or the joint you share with your sweetie. Can you consistently keep your mind focused on cultivating kindness, compassion, wisdom, and the practice that gets you there? If so, stop fretting about the rules and keep imbibing. After all, it's not Buddhism. It's about enlightenment. These were giving me some other kinds of perspective. So the final one is, in our lineage, the fifth precept is usually read this way. A disciple of the Buddha does not intoxicate mind or body or of self or others. This broadens the precept to refer not only to what we usually think of as intoxication of the body, but also mental intoxication, that is intoxication with drama, doctrines, or enthusiasms of any sort, and it includes trying to intoxicate others with these things. So it's often understood to be a cautionary precept for Zen students, and especially for teachers. Do not intoxicate yourself or others with your practice or your teachings, drawing others into your orbit in a cult-like manner. Be modest and down to earth. Avoiding your problems when partying now and then and getting a bit smashed for the fun of it is a violation of this precept. Some may argue that even a single glass of wine is a little bit intoxicating. While this may be chemically accurate, I don't look at it that way. By this same logic, taking mind-altering drugs, including marijuana, would be in violation of this precept because any use of such drugs will intoxicate. So I don't want to offer this precept to anyone who uses drugs other than alcohol. It is a well-known fact that in Japan, there are Zen priests who drink plenty, more or less ignoring this precept altogether. Japan has its own social history of morality that, like our Judeo-Christian culture, has its up and downsides. That was Norman Fisher. I don't think we have time to go into it, but I had to say, when I read the tricycle article, I thought, oh shit, I still have a lot of work to do. And I have to say, I think we're at our time, but I have to say that I really enjoyed being able to explore this with you guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to every person who's led a class and is going to. It's such a treat to just go into your mind and follow your exploration and hear from somebody other than me. All right. I'll say our closing phrase then. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you.
Say goodnight, Goose, since you've been a pest tonight. Say goodnight to everybody.
Aww.
He hasn't let me alone most of the night.
Stop licking your beard.
Yeah, he's licking my beard.
Salt your beard.
But he just thinks it needs to be cleaned.
He just does that.
There's an awful lot of cute pets tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Alice, your pet was so cute. Oh my gosh. Kitty cat.
Mm-hmm.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, all. Take care.